Cool. Let's get started. Hi, I'm Scott Linger. I am a functional front-end zealot with Beacon Fire Consulting. So I do a lot of HTML, CSS, some JavaScript, a little bit of PHP. But I get a little nervous when people throw out the word Node, which is why I have here bona fide developer, Rob Tarr, the Bunsen honeydew to my beaker. And I'll be doing the first half, and he'll be following up. We're going to start out, kind of zooming out and taking a more overview of sort of how shitcode kind of happens and some like more of the stuff I don't think we talk about as much. And then Rob's going to kind of follow up with more of the technical, heavy technical stuff. So, yeah, I'm going to go over how it happens, why it matters, and what to do about it. And also, right here in the front row, grabbing all the Twitter stuff is my boss, the bossest of bosses, Mark Lita. So if you have a question and want to throw it out on Twitter with the hashtag SXShit, he'll grab those and throw us the ones that are easy to answer or make us look good. And we'll also have some Q&A at the end with the mic there. So a caveat first. What this is not. So I thought about this, and I thought about how to put this together, and you know, I thought, well, at first, well, I'll just get all these awesome sort of tools and documentation and you know things to throw out. But I'm guessing there's a fair amount of you who are already familiar with those and who have your own. And you know, if you're a developer, you've got Perl, you've got MVC. If you're front end, you've got HTML5 boilerplate, things like that. So I thought, you probably have all those, but stuff still gets shitty. So how does that still happen? So that's kind of what I want to dig into a little bit. So the way this all started and the way I got this idea for doing the shit code workshop is this email I got a couple years ago. And it just said, style this. And I went, okay, what do you mean? And so it was a form for a website, and the site was already built. It was live, but they didn't have this form on it. And so I had to style this form so it didn't look like the default browser form. And the site was for Land Rovers and Jaguars, a car dealership. And it was pretty minimalist, kind of classy, upscale, had some nice panache. And so I thought, all right, we'll keep it classy. And so I did just a little bit of styling, some text treatment to separate the copy from headings and paragraph tags. And you know, just a tiny little pinstriper on the form fields, a subtle submit button, and then put some scripting on it that would do this nice key up blur. So when your form field was valid, you'd get the cute little checkbox at the end. And you know, that was a better part of a day's work. Thought it looked good, and that was that. And I came back the next day, and one of my colleagues was working on the form. And I thought, all right, I probably missed something. Maybe there's a bug. He's working on that. Went to lunch, came back, and he's still working on it. And I took a look, and he'd kind of gone crazy. It was now no longer a minimalist sort of subtle form that fit well in my perspective with the site, but it had all this bling to it. So this was 2005, 2006, the height of Web 2.0. So we had rounded corners, gradients, borders, inner shadows, outer shadows. The only thing that was missing was a purebred unicorn wrapped in bacon. So it was just the end. And I'm like, okay, what's going on here? And I kind of felt, you know, I kind of felt a little betrayed. Like I'd put my work into it. I thought it was done. I thought it was good. What the fuck? You know, what's this guy doing? And, you know, he doesn't say anything. He's just kind of jamming on it. And more than that, he'd also worked through the scripting and thrown that out and had a plugin going. And fine, I'm not against plugins, but he'd lost the sort of key up blur validation that happens on the fly, and now it had this sort of submit behavior. And I just didn't quite understand that and didn't understand why we wouldn't talk about it. And so that sort of set the stage for this, because we had things in place. We were both on the jQuery library. We had a good toolkit for the CMS and HTML and a lot of things that we did consistently, but there were still these issues coming up. So I've been thinking, how does this happen? And so I've got a short list of reasons. I've ordered this in order from most technical to sort of more personal issues. So you can see we start out with standards and conventions, CMSs, libraries and plugins, separating content behavior, those things you're familiar with. And then we get into nephew code, you know, which is where your aunt's sister's best friend's nephew does the code and they want to bring you in just to make a little fix, you know, nothing fancy. Then you have miscommunication mistakes, threw stress in there, and then at the end, laziness. So those are some of the ways that code sort of gets disrupted in this process. So next, I've gone and tried to categorize these into three. Ones you can probably fix, ones maybe you can fix, and then ones you're not going to be able to fix. And for you and your project, these might fit into different categories. But the more important thing is just that they exist. And so when you see your process sort of, you know, hit a brick wall or get disrupted, you know, try to figure out what's happening and try to fit it into one of those categories, because that can help you determine what the best solution is to fix that. And then I've also gone ahead and highlighted the ones that were in our situation. So we had miscommunication. We had competing libraries, so I was using just a thing I'd scripted, he was using a plugin. Personal preference, obviously, that was going on. And then I think stress was there, because we just didn't have a way to sort of work at this. So those are some of the ways I found that this kind of happens. And a lot of those I don't think we talk about as much, because they're not technical, but they're still there, they're still working under the surface. So why does it matter? You know, these things come up, we have issues, we could have just said, all right, we're going to have this super blinged out form, no big deal. But I think there is a reason, you know, a couple reasons why it does matter. The first is self-satisfaction. By the way, that's my little girl. She'll be turning 4 next month. But yeah, self-satisfaction. So you want to feel good about the code or the work you produce. You know, no one wants to, like, you know, that's part of the, I think, why this topic even resonated with the panel picker and all that stuff is the, you know, the feeling of betrayal. Like, you just feel like your legs have been cut out from under you. It's not a good place to be. And you want to be doing stuff that's exciting, that you feel good about, that at the end of the day, you're proud of. You know, I'm sure you've been in experience where you've launched a site and it just, over that process, isn't the site you hoped it was going to be, that you were excited about, and now you're just ready to get it done and get it out and get on to the next one. And you know what that feeling's like. And you lose a bit of that self-satisfaction. So I think that that's really important. Delivery. So not just you, but there's also people at the other end who are going to receive this. And even if they're not technical people, you know, they may hire someone down the road who is technical who's going to see this. They may work with another agency. You know, other developers who are going to see your work. And, you know, you want to be putting your best stuff out there. And lastly, maintenance. So you could be the person they call back later to address these issues. And, you know, if it's not your best code, you're going to have to figure out why on earth you did it that way in the first place and probably do some work catching up to speed on how all that happened. Yeah, so we've gone through a little bit of how it happens, which is a list of reasons. Some you can fix, some you can't. We've talked about why it matters, and we're going to look at what you can do about it. The first and most important thing, nip it in the bud. So flag the item in the process. So the earlier you can sort of recognize when things are falling apart, the better equipped you'll be to stop it from happening and keep it from dragging down your project. So in my case with this issue, I didn't do that. I kind of let it go on. You know, I went to lunch, came back, and it was this brand new thing, and I didn't really address it early on. And if we'd been able to have a conversation earlier, we may have been able to come to sort of a mutual understanding of this. Another example, there's a recent project at the office I'm at now where I was doing a cut for a site, and it was a list of things, so I coded a nice semantic list, sent it off to the dev team to put into the CMS, and a week later I get a bug ticket, and it just says, this page is broken, please fix. I'm going, all right, what's going on? So I take a look, and I see this, and it's like, come on now, You know, what is this? List item? It's a semantic list. Why would you intentionally just make it a list of divs? That's idiotic. And so I check in with the dev guys. You know, what's going on? And the reason was that sort of list item div class thing was built into the CMS we were using for this project. And I'm like, all right, well, just delete it and make it list. That's easy. And they're like, well, it's sort of buried in there and it affects a couple things. And if we need to make updates for security or whatever, then we've got to go back in and redo this again. It's just not going to be a simple fix. And in the time frame for the project, I'm not sure we're going to be able to do this. And it's like, all right. And I said, I gotcha. How about we flag it so that when we're done, we can fix it, so that going forward, when we use this tool on future projects, we, you know, can address this. And so we said, that sounds good. So what we were able to do is I wasn't making more pages with semantic lists for these types of situations. We didn't also get to the point where we were in a further development phase and the client was entering content and we had stuff blowing up. We were able to identify it early on and come up with a solution, and it wasn't the best solution, but I wasn't wasting any more of my time. We weren't wasting other people's time, and we could keep the thing on track. Second, collaborate across disciplines. So we do this really well at Beacon Fire. It's a great place to be, and I really appreciate that we do this so well. One of the things we do, we have these things called square tables, which every other week we get together, have pizza, and someone from one of the departments does just an informal presentation on either something they're doing, something they're passionate about, or something sort of in their field. But we have everybody in the office there. So communications, marketing, front end, back end, interface, designers, everybody's kind of there sharing in this. And it just makes it a lot easier to sort of understand what people are doing day to day. And when you go to address issues, you have a little bit more understanding of what their work is like and what they do and vice versa. And you get a vocabulary, so you have a better, you know, it's easier to dialogue with them. So that's important. Building rapport. Now, we don't talk about this a lot, but it's very important when you're just trying to get relationships with people. And this is something completely missing in my situation with this other guy. You know, I didn't feel like I could talk with him. Oh, I would have. You know, I was like, all right, he's in his world, he's doing his thing, I'm doing mine. So, you know, that's that, and I checked in later. But we didn't have a way to talk, even though our desks were 4 feet away. And it was just sort of the culture of that place and personalities between us that kept that from happening. I'd also emphasize the role of listening in building rapport. You know, that's, if you've seen, you know, I had a friend of mine who's getting a master's in counseling, and he took an entire class on ums and ahas. And basically all you do when you're working with someone is you're listening and you're saying mm-hmm and uh-huh. And they would critique him on the quality of his mm-hmms and ahas so that he could get better and so that it would show the patient he was working with that they were listening and that they were being heard. And another thing he learned to do in that class is to sort of rephrase what he was hearing and repeat it so that people know that they're being understood. And you're just going to get a lot farther than just sort of jumping right to, you know, your solution or what you want done. If you can sort of get everybody else in a situation where they feel like they're a participant and being heard and understood. So here's where we get to go to a really cool tangent. I'm really excited about this. This was my favorite class in college. It was a philosophy of language class, and we talked about Wittgenstein. And he was a language theorist in the 20th century, and had this thing called a language game. If you want to Google it further, you can Google Wittgenstein language games, or also the linguistic turn, if you'd like to be fancy. And he had this, in this language game, there were two actors. There was the speaker and the hearer. And he said the challenge with the speaker was getting what you wanted to communicate that was in your head into words, into a language. And he proposed, or he argued, that you're never going to fully be able to do that. There's always some distortion, some dissonance between what you think you're saying and what you're actually saying. And in the same token for the hearer, you know, what they think, the words they see and what they're interpreting, they think they've got complete capital T truth that they're in their mind resonating with. And Wittgenstein pushed back at that and said, there's always some dissonance and you're not going to have certainty with that. And he called this the language game. And in a language game, there's context, there's history, there's background, there's interactions. And in our case, there's also the medium. So you have, whether it's a tweet, an email, a phone conversation, Skype, or face-to-face, and all these different things in, you know, communicating are at issue when you're trying to get your message across or when you're trying to receive a message. And I think being aware of this is really key to, you know, just having a sort of charity and hospitality when miscommunication happens or when you feel like you're not on the same page. I think it's important for our audience, particularly coders, because in, you know, more of a design space, you know, people have studied Derrida, a lot of philosophy, and there, you know, there's this idea that art is interpreted, and you can't just create something and say, this is what it is, and that's why assholes can make a can of soup and call it art, because it's an interpretation, and they're making a claim on this, and that sort of thing. But with coders, things can get very conditional. It's true or false. It's binary. It's if or else. And it's hard, or I think it's more challenging for those types of folks sometimes to really wrestle with the gray and the vague and that what you're saying may not be what the other person's hearing. So to illustrate this, he came up with what's called the duck rabbit. And so he drew this thing and said, you know, it could be that the speaker was assigned to draw a duck. So he did. But the hearer sees a rabbit. And both are true, but it's all in the context and the situation and people's backgrounds and history of how this is interpreted. And this just sort of illustrates how, you know, we need to be a little more understanding and, you know, forgiving in our discourse. Yeah, so that's a little more about rapport. Lastly, knowing when to compromise. Hopefully, if you've got those other things going, the process, the collaboration, the rapport, you don't end up here. But yeah, in terms of compromising, you know, in the last situation I talked about with the list items, that's what we did. I said, I'm going to move forward with this goofy nested divs with a class of list. But you're going to compromise with me by fixing this after we get this project done. So going forward after that, we're going to have a nice solution. And so I think that was a really good compromise we reached. My second tangent, or when compromising, check yourself. So it's you know, when we're trying to compromise, you know, we always want the other person to change or them to relent, and it's a lot harder to figure out where our place is in the negotiation. And it's also another thing we miss is sort of the social balance that's happening whenever you're in a negotiation. These first two items, dependent and independent, you might recognize if you've read Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He's got a middle ground that he calls being interdependent. I want to push back at that and say that that's sort of something you can hope for but never quite reach. So you may always be getting closer to an interdependence, but you're always going to be in a dynamic. And to sort of qualify that in more the psychology realm, you have these ideas, these similar ideas of codependency and counterdependency. And you've probably heard of codependency. That gets thrown a lot. Counterdependency, we don't often hear about as much, but when you have one, you have the other guaranteed. And so they're sort of working against each other, and this was exactly going on in the situation with me and the former problem with the form. I was being a bit more dependent, codependent. What's he thinking? Why is he doing this? I don't know. And getting all nervous and, you know, not knowing what to do about it. And he's just total, full blast, independent, couldn't give a rip, doing his own thing because he thought it was right and didn't, you know, give a hoot why I had made the decisions I had made in styling and scripting that form. And so being aware of how what's going on when you have these issues is going to help you figure out where you're at and figure out where the other person's at, and that'll give you some clues as to how to, you know, work in that negotiation or working towards a compromise. And so why I've got these arrows here is because it's not necessarily, you know, an extreme. And depending on the other person, you may be closer, they may be one spot, you may be another, and it can reverse depending on the other person. So you're not necessarily always going to be, you know, the dependent. So your codependence, there's hope you might be a counterdependent someday. But you're always going to be, you know, somewhere in that spectrum. So being able to think about that and keep that in mind, you know, when you've got some code or something you're trying to resolve is really going to help. And I thought this quote was good to keep in mind. We tend to just sort of, you know, we're always seeing through our own lens and our own eyes, and, you know, I thought this other guy was just a fucking jackass. You know, like, come on. You know, I just was just, my shoulders were all tense, and, you know, I was just getting so frustrated. And evil's a bit strong, but this is the quote, so that's what I'm going with. But, yeah, just the idea that even when you think someone's totally wrong and why are they doing something, somewhere they think what they're doing is the right thing. And, you know, I had a reason why I thought a super glossy, squirrely Web 2.0, you know, aesthetic for this form wasn't right. This person had a reason why they thought it was, and even a reason why they were going to kind of redo what I was doing to try to get to that. So, you know, as much as you want to demonize people, being able to recognize that what there's a reason they're doing what they're doing, and trying to perceive that is going to be crucial to, you know, building that rapport, that collaboration. So to wrap my part up, we've talked about how it happens, which is a long list of reasons, and some you can fix and some you can't, and to try to figure out where those lie. We've talked about why it matters, self-satisfaction, delivery, maintenance, and I've gone through a little bit of some things you can do about that. A process, rapport, compromise, and just sort of working through the people issues with that. So to sort of segue one of the guys on our tech team threw this out. And I thought it was great, because we think of artists as sort of these emotional people who, you know, just... And we see it, because they hand off their design to, you know, the client for review, and they get this stupid feedback, like, I hate the color blue, and all this stuff. And you're like, what am I going to do with that? You know, and there's all this obscure, you know, irrelevant criticism, and we don't have that as much on a coding level, because it's not as visible. But, you know, when something gets broken or distorted, there's still that feeling that hurts. It's that same feeling of when the designer hears, I hate blue, and what are you thinking? So, yeah, just the idea that coders have feelings too. So always sort of remember that, you know, when you're working through these technical issues and trying to come to solutions. Yeah, so I'm going to hand it over to Rob now, and he's going to dig a little into the more of the tech stuff. And then we'll, you know, wrap up with 10 minutes or so for some Q&A and check the Twitter stuff.
All right, so somebody did ask if we're going to have our slides available, and they will be. I think we're going to put them up on SpeakerDeck probably, but they'll be there shortly. So my name is Rob Tarr. I'm a developer at Sparkbox. I spend most of my time doing JavaScript, HTML, CSS, Ruby, PHP, and everything that goes in there. So we do you know, WordPress installs, corporate sites, custom web apps. This is the kind of stuff that I get to do. So I want to share with you some of my experiences from a developer standpoint, you know, working on small teams and large teams, kind of how some of this stuff has affected me. So we have a small but mighty team at Sparkbox. You know, we sit all together in one space. And we do a lot of front-end development. And so I've been fortunate in this. We get to do a lot of greenfield stuff, right? Like I get a task and a blank canvas and say, go, which is great. You know, I love it. This is probably my favorite point in developing an app, because I can make all the right decisions. I can choose all the right frameworks and libraries, have all the best intentions. You know, nothing holds me back. And this is the fun point for me. I can look at it and just go, okay, what are we going to do? The problem with this is that, you know, the tendency for, you know, what happens in big fields like this is things like this, right? And this is often, I feel like, what code turns into part, you know, towards the end of a project. You know, and so we want to find ways to mitigate this and, you know, end up with something more like this when we get done. You know, the big, nice double rainbow. So like I said, so we're a front-end shop, and I like old trucks, so there's our front-end. We've established some relationships with some places that do a lot of back-end code. So we've been able to do, you know, build on top of that. We have relationships, you know, they'll do the back-end code for client, we'll do the front-end code. So generally when we're co-oping with a team like that, you know, I'm responsible for HTML, CSS, JavaScript, you know, writing JSON APIs to communicate with their backend so everything stays in sync. This means there's lots of points of handoff in our code, right, between us and them. It also means there's lots of points of failures, right, for every one of those things, for the HTML, the CSS, JavaScript, the folder structure we use, conventions that we use for how we do things. Every point that there's a question that I need to ask a designer or a developer, you know, something is another point where there can be some sort of failure between our team and their team. So as soon as we start to hit some of these points, you know, that's what makes us sad. And when all too often I find that we get towards the end of a project, you know, and I'm saying things like, you know, this code is so messy, you know, we should have done it this way, not this way. You know, when is the project going to be over? You know, when can we move on to something else? Right. I don't want to do that. I want to have it be that fun, you know, greenfield experience the whole way through. You know, it's just not fun anymore at that point. So the question then is, you know, what do we do? How do we stay, you know, avoid that time? So working on these types of projects, we work with other clients, as well as working on our own internal projects. We're constantly trying to improve our processes, right? It's an evolutionary step. We're constantly trying to find ways to make it better, right? And it's slow sometimes, but we're always trying to do the best we can for our clients. We can provide them the best code. So I want to spend some time looking at, you know, in where we are in our evolutionary processes, we're trying to find ways to kind of fix some of this stuff. So where we started was trying to clean up the CSS. I had a project a year or so ago where I was working on with another guy. It was a large site, and we were responsible for the HTML and the CSS, and I did the majority of the JavaScript that we did with this other client. And at the time, you know, we'd done a couple similar projects, and we were starting to see a lot of points where there was some commonalities, and things were starting to fall apart, and we were getting these points that were just, you know, these cringe moments, right? You know, where things were breaking down. So this is where, you know, we began several long conversations around the pool table about how we can solve some of these problems. So the first thing we saw was class names. You know, and for us, this was a no-brainer, right? This was the first thing we're seeing, though. But we get these calls like, you know, this website is broken. This, you know, this page doesn't look how it's supposed to. So we go look at the code, and like, this is what we would have sent them, you know, something kind of like this, right? And we look at the code that they implemented in their, you know, in their CMS, and it looks something like this. And we go, okay, well, you have to apply all the same class names for all this stuff to work. You know, and for us, that was like, it was a no-brainer, right? Like, that has to be there. But, you know, without that, it's just not going to work. So we started seeing these things breaking down. The other thing we saw was cascade problems, right? We'd have something like this, and then, you know, like, they'd add something like this. So now we've got, you know, they'd override the color. Or no, sorry, you know, it wouldn't override the color, it wouldn't override the font size, because it's not as specific, right? But now we're adding padding. And then, you know, we'd get stuff like this, where they'd add in, you know, padding over here, and all of a sudden, like, they don't understand necessarily all of how these things, you know, then, you know, text indent 100 and things are off the page, and they wouldn't necessarily understand how all these things are affecting things. And we don't expect them to, right? The backend guys are trying their best to do it. They don't understand necessarily the front end like we do. Same way, like, I don't understand all the ASP.NET that they're writing in the back end. You know, we need to find those roles, and we need to not assume that everybody understands every part of the development process. It just doesn't work. You know, we have to communicate like our job depends on it. So, you know, these things, we started seeing a lot of these problems. And so this link is to this blog post. Right. And this is kind of, you know, what we want to do. We want to try to find ways to mitigate problems like this, right? So instead of depending upon the cascade for all these things, oh, you can't see that. The browser's on the wrong one. Can you see that? So I'm going to read it backwards. But Mark talks about, like, you know, if you have these encapsulated things on your page that they need to have, they need to be classed, and we can target these specific things, right? So if you've got a modal dialog in your box, make sure that everything in that, all the CSS in that, is scoped to just that thing. Right? So the cascade, you know, we kind of break the cascade off at that point, right? And it's helping take things like this and teaching people around us, you know, here's how we need to do this, you know, so that they can not continue to break things. But so this is linked in the slides. That's a great article if you're doing large scale CSS stuff. So, but what we noticed was like, there's, you know, pulling back and looking at it and going, okay, there's definitely problems with handing things off to these other teams. But that's not the root of the problem. There's also problems with the way we're handling things internally before it even gets to the other team. So we step back and look at the process of creating these templates and these designs and found some problems in taking things from Photoshop to HTML and the CSS. There were issues in this design. And it wasn't necessarily even the designer's fault, I don't think. We had a large site and lots of pages, lots of client revisions, and lots of design changes along the way. But what happened is we ended up with a lot of inconsistencies. So we had, this is a small sample of some of the buttons that were on this site, right? And so we had, you know, some buttons that had icons on them, and some that were, you know, really wide, some that were narrow, some that were shorter for, you know, just because of the way they sat in the design. So we had all these things, and I kept having to ask these questions. Okay, is this one supposed to be like this? Is this one supposed to have 10 pixels more padding than this one? Is this one supposed to be taller? And all these questions that I kept having to go back to the designer and ask. And we're like, this is tiring. It's ridiculous. And the problem was is that there were actually a few different styles of buttons to fit the different pages, but there were so many inconsistencies even across what needed to be the same thing. So that instance right there is what kind of became the driving force for me for kind of finding a solution for, okay, we need to keep things from being so chaotic in our CSS, because if we can minify that, then we can help prevent those things from breaking down the road as we pass things on to backend guys. So this handoff from designer to developer needed to have some significant improvements. So I've had a lot of conversations with one of our designers about how we can fix this problem. You know, we talked about, you know, do we during the design stage, you know, have the designers create all these little modules and things as they're designing. You know, maybe making smart objects in Photoshop and reusing those in our documents. And you know, we came to the conclusion basically that would hinder the design process too much. Right, and we work with great designers, and I don't want to do anything to them that's going to hinder their ability to create really, really good interfaces. So we decided that instead of having the designers create all these, you know, objects and things that they're going to reuse in the page, that we just let them design how they do. But when we get to the end of that process and we're handing that code off to the developer, we'd stop and we'd sit down and have a discussion right then, you know, half hour, hour, whatever it takes, to find the things in the site where we can identify reuse. We can take these things and say, okay, you know, this page it's this wide, and this page it's this wide. It could probably be the same. You know, we can figure out the places in the code, you know, in the mockups where things are different but should be the same, or different they really need to be the same. But having that discussion in that process, you know, if it's an hour, it's going to save me and him a bunch of time, and me from having to keep pestering him while I'm writing code and interrupting his flow for whatever else he's doing that he's moved on to keep answering questions about the things that we're trying to solve. So we've got an example. This is a site that we did recently. This is dressresponsibly.com that we put together. And this was the design that we got. This is the front page there, that big, tall You Decide. This was the home page, and then on the other side there is the third page, which is a detail page about this specific T-shirt. And so as we're writing out the HTML for this, we noticed, like, okay, these two things are very similar, right? We've got on the front page, we've got this current leader section. It's got this T-shirt, this black background, with some texture, and, you know, some details about the shirt. And then on the detail page, we've got a really similar section. It's not exactly the same, though. When we put these two things together, we're like, okay, they're pretty much the same, but why do they look different where they are different? Right, there are a lot of similarities. Right, these are my cheesy no presentation is complete without some cheesy animation, right? So you know, like the paragraphs are the same, or they have the same background, right? They both have this T-shirt. They both have this paragraph text about the shirt. They both have a title, but the title's not the same. Or they both have this vote count, but the vote count's not quite the same. Right? They both have a title for the teacher, but the title's not quite the same. We've got this button on the front page that says, see more details about it, and a similar button on the detail page where you can vote for this shirt in the context of this app. The front page has this current leader. The inside one doesn't. So there's a lot of things that are, the Twitter and this other link, all these things are like, they're very similar, yet there's actually a lot of differences. But we can find ways to mark them up that are very close, right? We want the benefits of this. We can get a cleaner design. We can have similar markup between pages, which means less code to maintain, and we can reuse that CSS across those pages. We can minimize how much code we have to write. And I'm always a proponent of writing less code. It means less stuff to maintain, less stuff to deal with, smaller file sizes, all of these things. Part of the problem was that, some of this was intentional, some of it needed to be different, but some of it just came naturally out of the design process. The home page was done first, things were added to the design, it was just coded, the detail page was kind of third, and the design had been more thought out, so there were more things applied to it. So we asked our designer, what if we did this? What if we take this, the treatment of the votes on the detail page and apply it back to the home page? And what we ended up with was here's the original detail page with the final detail page, right? And then the original home page with the final home page. And then once we put all that stuff together, we end up with essentially the same thing. But this way, we had a lot less code that was different between the two, right? So if we're doing pages that have templates, we can maybe make these one template instead of two. There's a lot less CSS to deal with. And it actually kind of unified the design, through having this process of discussion about, before we take it from design to development, we were able to go back through and kind of clean some of that up and maintain the same feel of that design all the way through. So all this stuff has kind of led to this style guide. And this is the first iteration of the style guide, going back to the other project. And really what this is one page that has all the elements from our site. Right, so this was a large project. This is a small portion of that design. And it has, all the buttons, search bars, icons, these little widgets that are on the page. And it gives us one place to go, okay, what do all these things look like? Are they broken? Are there inconsistencies? And so the thing was this gave us one place, right? So we have all these pieces in one HTML file with the production CSS applied to this. So we can see if there's problems with cascade. If we have, things that aren't scoped to the right thing and we change the size of an H1 somewhere, if it changes any of these things, we can see here on this one page if that broke anything else. So we can take these and we can insert these any place in the site with a little bit more, hope that they're not going to break. We've been trying to figure out, this is the best I've found so far to kind of test our CSS. And if anybody has a better way to test CSS, I would love to talk to you about it. We've thrown out lots of ideas, and none of them have seemed to make sense or be sane or doable or reasonable. So this is kind of our best step at this point to say, hey, let's test it and see what it looks like. We change our CSS. We can kind of get a glance at all the pieces of the site. So what that led me to was we started trying to work on this thing, and then I came across this from Jeremy Keith. He created this pattern primer, and if I can see it, okay. So this is what Jeremy did. He was working kind of the same thing, right? He has all these different bits of markup, and then what they look like. So, he's got feedback messages and error states and buttons and form elements, and then off to the right of that, he's got the code, the HTML code for what that thing should look like. I was like, this is great. And I started working with it, but I was like, it didn't have everything I wanted. Like, I want to be able to see the CSS. I want to do some more with it. So I started working on some, kind of forking his project from GitHub and modifying it. And then just a couple weeks ago, Dan Cederholm at Invent Apart announced that he'd been working on this project, which is Pairs. And Pairs is a very similar thing. That's the wrong one. Sorry. All right, well, it's PEA.RS. I'm not going to keep trying to get it, but Dan put together a very similar thing, but it sits on top of WordPress, and it gives you access to the HTML and the CSS, and you can see it live right there. The problem with this was I still was like, well, it's not quite what I want, you know. And we talked about it, maybe implementing his and changing it a little bit, and it wasn't really easy to use on the back end of WordPress. But there was no JavaScript, and I really wanted to tie. I'm a JavaScript guy at heart, so I'm like, I really want to tie JavaScript to some of these patterns, right? Like, if we have a navigation, I want to be able to see what the JS is to go with that navigation, because I'm tired of writing navigation code. I do it for every project, and I don't need to do it anymore. We want to solve the problem and do it once. And so we want to tie the JavaScript to that. I also want to be able to export all this stuff to a single file and keep it in a project, so I can create that style guide for this project so I can have that to reference while I'm building it. And I want to have version control, right? We want to be able to see how things have changed, where things have changed, and have more control over what's happening to this repository of code. So what we decided to do was just kind of roll our own, which I love doing anyways, because I just like to write code. So we're in the process of kind of folding this into our everyday workflow. So we started doing this, and it looks... I can't see the screen. That's it. So this gives us the ability to list out this pattern library down the left-hand side, right? All these different little components and things that are on our site, you know, things that we can start with. So I can click on, if I can see it. Am I over something? There we go. Right, so I can see that. It's a text area. I can see what a text area is going to look like with the CSS applied. I can see the HTML. There's no CSS for this one. There's no JavaScript. But I can see all those things there. I can grab that. If we come up with a new pattern for, you know, the best way to input put a text area in our HTML, we can save that in here. And now when somebody else needs to go create a form, you know, they can say, you know, maybe your company has a specific way or something that they have to do for the way they do forms. We can save that in here. And then every time we need to do a form, I don't have to worry about what that is. I don't have to worry about somebody else doing it a little bit differently. I can grab this code and I can you know, check those checkboxes there. And I can see here, let me just do this. There we go. So I can go here and I can say, I want all the forms, I want all the things in our context. And I'm going to say, build this. And of course it's going to fail. It's a horrible demo. There we go. Sorry. The goal though, right, is that I can build myself kind of a starter kit with all the HTML, all the CSS, and all the JavaScript that I want to start with to give me that style guide so that I can apply that to the start of a site. And this helps us to, you know, have these starting points and similarities and keep consistency across all the things that we're doing. So kind of our little roadmap, as we've been talking about that, we've actually been working on this quite a bit while we're here trying to get it done, so it's still a little bit buggy. But the goal is to get this up and kind of give people access to use this. And what we want to do is, you know, kind of further separation of that, the code that handles this framework and the library code that is all these patterns, and add the ability to kind of create a pattern library on GitHub and pull that in. And then, you know, and then just that way we can have however many, you know, repos with patterns in it and just pull them in. But that would give us the ability to say, you know, hey, I have some specific modules for this application. I can just put those in a repo in GitHub. I can point this app at that repo, and I can see all these things, and I can pull them in, and I can check it out and generate these files that way. So we're using this now as, you know, kind of pulling this in as a part of our process. And one of the things that happens is, you know, I may solve a problem, and I may do something this way, or, you know, we may sit down and talk and go. We had an example recently. We had a nav where we And we sat down and we all discussed how it should be done, right? What it was going to do. But then we didn't talk about how to implement it. So then one of the guys went off and did it, and he did it, you know, the way he thought it should be done. It was a really complex nav, had a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of tricky parts to it. And when it came back, I thought, well, you know, I probably would have done it this way, and maybe we should. And then we had a discussion, and at that point, we're like, okay, now we got to go back and redo it. And if we'd had that discussion ahead of time, or had some patterns already established for this thing, then we can mitigate some of that, you know, time loss in creating these applications. The other thing we get then is like, I can solve the problem of a nav, and I have this. And if that solution doesn't solve the problem that I have now, then I can solve the problem. I can put that back into this pattern library. And now I have it solved for next time. So I don't have to keep solving all these things over again. Because as much as I love to write code, I don't want to keep writing the same code over and over again. I want to solve new problems and solve them better. So, you know, if you use something like, you know, like Jeremy's thing or Dan's or something like this, or, you know, roll your own, I encourage you to use some sort of pattern to do that. So, you know, just a couple suggestions from, you know, what I've picked up from doing some of this stuff is just to communicate. You know, designer, developer communication, and then from like front end to back end, if we just hand things off and throw them over the wall and then wait for it to come back, it's probably not going to be what you want. You know, there's so many questions that need to be asked throughout that process. You know, and we're fortunate. We all sit in one room, and I don't know how many people are fortunate enough to do that and just be like, you know, throw a dart at somebody and ask them a question, or, you know, just yell at somebody, hey, you know, can you come look at this? But that communication is key to keeping things from falling apart, because as soon as you, you know, assume things, you know, there's at least a 50-50 chance it's going to go wrong. You know, I think being consistent and finding ways to create those moments of like, you know, we have, this is our established thing for this, you know, our environment. I worked at a company a long time. We had a wiki. We kept all our best practices in this wiki. The problem with that is somebody has to maintain it, right? Somebody needs to own it. You can't just throw that out and say, okay, everybody maintain this wiki, right? Like, you've got to give ownership to somebody to say, okay, you know, you monitor our best practices, make sure that they stay on top. And then you've got to be on top of everybody else to use those things, because you can establish all these patterns and, you know, ways to do things, but if people don't follow them, then, you know, it's pointless. We always start with a boilerplate. So we took the HTML5 boilerplate, Paul Irish and those guys did. We forked our own copy. That's that second link there up on GitHub. And we put our own icons. You know, we do some things a little bit differently than the boilerplate. So we have that built out into the way that we develop code. And so we start every project now with this in the same place. So that at least, if nothing else, we have this starting point that's the same, right? Everybody knows, you know, why these things are at the start of a file, you know, what's in there at the beginning, because we've all gone over it, and somebody owns that code, right? And it doesn't get changed unless people agree on it and, you know, it gets approved, and that everybody knows what's happening with it, right? And then use patterns. I mean, I said this already, like, find ways to use those things and be consistent. Review code. You know, we don't really do formal code reviews. And I was talking about this with somebody else just the other day. I think, you know, waiting till the end and reviewing our code doesn't really work for us, because at that point, if we've made poor decisions, we have to go back and redo it. You know, and we often work on tight deadlines, and we don't have time always to go back and redo things. And I think if we can kind of work these code reviews in, so like when we say, hey, this is what we're going to do, somebody go off and do it, if we can have a short discussion, say, hey, here's how I would do it, you know, how would you do it? And we can have those back and forth and try to come up with answers ahead of time and kind of do like this pre-code review, then, and maybe we can touch on it again later then, but that way we have, you know, we've hashed out some of the problems, and we don't have to come back to things afterwards. Like, I'll tell you what, and every time I'm working on code and I'm like, that's kind of crappy, I'll come back to that and fix it later. You know how often I actually get back to coming back and fixing it? Never. Right? Like, it doesn't happen. If you say you're going to come back and do it, I don't know about you guys, but it gets lost. You know, unless I write, you know, to do, and then I remember to search my code for to do before I'm done with it, like, it's not going to get done. And then, you know, lastly, my last suggestion, we didn't talk really about JavaScript and those things, but I think code needs to be tested. I mean, like, there's no good way to test HTML, right? There's no good way to test CSS. It's too visual. I mean, I suppose you could write some tests to see if DOM elements are present, but you know, depending on what you're doing. But when it comes to things like JavaScript and PHP and Ruby or, you know, whatever you're doing, I guarantee you there's some sort of test framework for whatever you're developing in. You know, we're doing more and more testing of our code and, you know, writing these tests and building code on these tests. And I'll tell you what, it's a relief for me to write all these tests, because I know that if my tests pass, at least everything that I think it should do, it's doing, right? And if I have to come back later and change something, or I have to give it to somebody else and they have to change something, or I get somebody else's code and I go, I don't know what you're doing, I'm going to make this change because I think this is what needs done, and I can run the tests and they all still pass, I'm a lot more confident that I didn't break something that I didn't know about, right? And that's a big thing. When we start working on big sites with JavaScript, you know, and things across multiple files, and we may not see if it's being pulled in dynamically through Ajax or whatever. Like, there's so many questions that can happen. But if I can go, I'm going to make a change, I'm going to run your test suite, I may add a test for what I'm changing, and it all still passes, it is a load off my shoulders, because there's nothing I hate more than saving something, saying it's done, pushing out to, you know, a production server, and then hearing, hey, it's broken in IE. Like, oh, crap. Right? And we've all been there. We've done it. You know, and these are ways to mitigate that. So I encourage you to find a test framework for whatever it is that you're coding in. So I think we've got some time if we want to take questions or anything. I don't know if there's anything that came through on Twitter.
Nope. Hey, that pattern library you set up looks awesome. Looks super awesome. But it seems a little static. Like, I think what you were saying is, like, when you wanted to like work on it, you'd like work on it elsewhere, and then once you were happy with it, you'd like, I guess, bring it back into here somehow. Is that how that worked?
So my goal with that, and really, like, my goals are still kind of in flux. Like, we're working on this. Like I said, like I pushed code to that server like an hour ago.
Yeah.
The goal is that we have one place where we have all these you know, patterns, right? Forms, text boxes, you know, all, you know, navigations, and then we can continue to add that. So we build this library of code that we can use on projects. And that when I start a project, I would pull the things in that I need for that. And if I need to add things for that project, then I would add them, but then push them back up to the main repo, so that we're continuing to build. But I don't want necessarily need, you know, if I have to build some widget for some thing for this application, there's a good chance it has no bearing on any other application. So I don't necessarily need to push that back up. But I want to be able to use it for this application to be able to test with and have for other people to use.
Seeing those like three boxes of like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, like it reminds me so much of like JS Fiddle and how like, you know, like you can fiddle with it right there and like hit run and see it, and like it'd be awesome. It'd be so cool if there was a site kind of like this where you can maybe like edit it and then just like save it to your repository right there. And
yeah, so like we actually talked about that. There was a version where you could edit it and save it.
Right.
But seeing as that we have these, they're essentially, you know, they're each of those patterns is a flat file in the app.
Yep.
And it's in our GitHub repo. There's a lot of problems with like editing it there and then pushing it to the GitHub repo and having it, you know, creating a pull request and then being out of sync with a server. So we talked about it. We haven't really worked through that yet. I don't know if that's going to happen. Right now we're just editing it, you know, locally and then pushing it up. But that's kind of still in the works. And I, you know, hey, we're developers, right? You can fork it on GitHub and
yeah, definitely. But great job. Looks great.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'll add something to that.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, so we're kind of doing a similar thing at Beacon Fed to this. My presentation was elsewhere. But one of the things kind of in iterating stuff and making updates is we've got this model where, so we'll have like a slideshow. And slideshows are real tricky because they're usually, like they're all unique. You know, we've rarely done a slideshow that's exactly the same as another slideshow. But we want to kind of try to keep using the same stuff. And so we've kind of set it up where there's like the solution, which is the slideshow, but then we also have the implementation. And so they sort of connect, and then we track the implementations by client. And so they all kind of point back to the source, but we can keep track of how they've iterated
you know, through time, and if we need to pull something similar to, you know, client D later on, we can go grab that. So, yeah.
Hey, I had a question about code review processes. I run a team of 9 developers, and we have published 7 sites biweekly, and I feel like it's always running wild, and I'm always doing emergency fixes, rolling back live builds, and I just wondered what kind of processes or tools we should use for code reviews, or if you know of anything.
So yeah, I'm like, I don't really know of any tools for that. You know, I've done a couple different ways. You know, I used to work in a corporate environment. We would, you know, like every Friday, we'd have code reviews, and we'd stand up, we'd go line by line through all the code. You know, and honestly, like, those are really expensive meetings.
Yeah.
You get the whole dev team in there for like an hour and a half to look at code.
You lose a lot.
I don't know a lot of shops, you know, that size, they could probably afford to do that, right?
Right.
That's why, you know, and we don't really do formal code reviews right now, but we're trying to do, like I said, like this more like conversational, like in-process code review. But, you know, our dev team is a lot smaller. We've got, you know, 4 or 5 guys that are writing code. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, maybe a little bit different. I don't know. What do you guys do with Beacon Fire?
Ours is, yeah, I guess a bit of everything. It just depends on the scope of the project. We're a smaller, like 30-person agency, but the dev team's around 10. And it just sort of just kind of depends on the scale of the project and things. So.
Hi, I have a question. It might be slightly a tangent, but it's definitely related to adapting code and politics in an office. I'm with a small company on a team of about 2.5 developers for a certain product. One thing that I have a lot of trouble with that I'd appreciate any insight into is when you detect a problem with code, how do you sell management and the VP and the president on the fact that you need to allocate resources either now or after the product ships, whenever, but resources have to be allocated to renovate this code just to do maintenance when they say, well, it works. It works, and we have a schedule, and we need another product out by June, so we don't see a motivating factor here to just refactor.
So how do you sell it to management that we need to fix bugs that they don't know about?
Right. Or not even bugs necessarily, just really crappy design that's going to prevent you from moving forward if you're going to migrate the same code and libraries to other projects in the future, which they expect. They expect this product in June just to have all the functionality of the March product, and it can't do that without some really heavy work, and if we did it right the first time, it wouldn't be as necessary.
Yeah, I think, you know, for us, I don't do a lot of interfacing with our clients. I pretty much just write code all day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, that's one of those things where, like, if we really try to write it right the first time, right? And, like, a lot of times it doesn't happen. But knowing that, you know, this project is going to get built upon further down the road, I think the best thing that, you know, we can try to do is go, okay, looking down the road, I know that I'm going to have to do this. And if I can write it this way now, it's going to take me this long. You know, it's going to cost you this much money. If I write it, you know, really quickly, it's going to be cheaper now, but it's going to be a lot more money down the road. You know, like that would probably be, you know, hey, it's your decision. It's your money. It's your time. You know, if you need it quickly, we can do it, but it's going to cost you a lot more money in the long run.
Well, part of the situation I'm thinking of is we've just hired a new developer, and she's wonderful, and we see great potential in her, but sometimes when I'm reviewing her code, I see some problems. It's not that the code is bad, it's that it doesn't fit well with our patterns and architecture.
Yeah.
So that's a case of reviewing someone else's code and saying, I know we talked about this, but we didn't talk about this enough. And now...
Yeah, and that's exactly why I wanted this pattern library, was so I can go, hey, if you need to do this, get it from here. You know, if it's not in here, let's talk about it. Let's figure out a good solution. And kind of that's like this kind of pre-code review. Let's talk about how it should be done before you go off and write it all. And that way, at least there's some guidance ahead of time to say, here's what should happen. And then maybe, you know, if it's somebody new like that, you know, maybe they need to be, you know, just, hey, you know, check it in every day, and we'll kind of look over the changes. If you take 5 minutes to say, okay, what are the changes today from yesterday? you know, that may be a way to help mitigate some of that risk of, you know, getting too far down the line before you realize that things have gotten pretty bad.
And I would even add, for your previous question, patience. Because it just sounds like the way you described it, you're just not being heard by the management. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to, you know, get people to hear that, well, there's a problem here and they don't see it. They don't see it, you know. And so there's a, you know, so I think you need to do some work in sort of working up to that point where you can kind of be heard and trusted. And so that goes back to, you know, more the dynamics. And so I would, you know, maybe try to see what you could do there. Because it sounds like you've made the argument and it's just, you know, that's not working. And with the issue with the new hire, like what Rob said with the pattern, that's a great idea because it's sort of, you know, something besides the two of you going at each other. It's a, you know, thing you can kind of talk through and work through and maybe even see, you know, try to understand what their decision making is for the way they're doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, and if it's like naivety or whatever, you know, that's one thing. If it's that they've got a good reason, you know, you got to kind of flesh that out and then approach it that way. So,
great. Thank you.
Do we have time for one more?
Yeah, of course. Make it
quick. Okay, make it quick.
Do you have experience with managing reusable, like, front-end code from the other side, like SAS or LESS, using mixins and building libraries that way versus doing it from, like, the Bootstrap class kind of structure?
I didn't hear the last part.
Like, versus, it looks like you're, at least from the CSS point of view, building reusable, basically doing it from the Bootstrap point of view of saying, like, here are these classes, apply these classes.
Versus, you're saying, like, using, like, SAS mixins for some of that stuff?
Well, versus building actual code libraries that you use mix into your CSS, or have you played around with that? Or
yeah, we haven't actually done that, but that's actually okay. A great idea to kind of build a mix-in file from that stuff to do it.
Okay. I guess my question would be, like, ideas for how to then present that as in the kind of tool that you have, which is actually a problem that we're kind of facing where we're. We are approaching that kind of stuff using mix-ins, but then how do we actually sort of even evangelize that to our own developers is really hard.
So. Yeah, I would say, like, kind of turning this into, like a way to generate the mix-ins needed for a project.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be a bad way to do it. We use SAS right now for most of our projects.
Cool.
And, like, if you download our boilerplate, you'll see that, like, kind of how we structure all our SAS. And we have a mix-ins file that we're pulling in.
Okay.
So it would be great to kind of, generate that out and save it as a mix-ins file.
Cool.
Yeah, we do that. We found that SAS provides us a lot of, you know, a lot more than just, you know, even like hierarchy and things. We actually use that to serve up different files for IE, for responsive stuff. But yeah, I think creating mixins for those would be a really good way to do that.
Cool. Thanks.
Cool.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.